You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. Interstate Batteries offers a wide variety of batteries for your everyday needs. Stop into one of their thousands of retail locations and talk with a battery specialist about batteries for your truck, trail cameras, and even those weird batteries for your rangefinder. Interstate Batteries even offers cell phone repair in certain locations. For more information, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Hey everybody, thanks again for tuning in to this week's episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast. I'm running around like a chicken with my head cut off. I don't know about you. I always feel like when it's hunting season and I'm in the season I want to be in, doing the things I want to do, that's when everything else is going on. It just makes things get more chaotic. So as we speak, as I'm recording this introduction for this week's episode, it is Wednesday night of the first week of deer season. And I am doing everything I can to pack up and get ready because I'm headed up to my cabin, which is in Lycoming County, to do some group hunting. We're going to be doing some drives and might be doing a little bit of still hunting on our own, exploring some new areas, doing some historic areas that we've done drives in that have produced very well for us. And I'm really, really excited for that and have a crew of friends and family that are doing that. I look forward to this hunt every year. But before I do that, I knew I needed to get our episode ready for this week because I want to keep that coming to you guys weekly on Fridays. So here's a goofy thing. It's really not a big deal, but it had me all worked up at first, but it's all good now. I made a map. So I took my I've been using Onyx, and I've made a printed map. It was like 24 inches by 36 inches of the hunting area with my Onyx. I made this map, and it had all my important pins of reference. I had chop-offs outlined that had fences around them versus didn't have fences around them, and all these important pieces of the puzzle that was going to be really, really helpful for me to show people on a map where we were hunting, how I wanted people to be taken in for stands, how I wanted to be taking people in for the drive, making sure people understand where we're going and hunting and how the drive is going to work. Just thought it would be a way to increase efficiency. So I get this map made and decide I'm just going to take it to Staples to get laminated. That way I could take a dry erase marker and draw all over it, and then when I was finished, erase it and do what I, you know, go on my business with it. And they lost my map. I dropped it off like over a week ago. I called. I'm like, hey, I haven't heard anything. What's going on? They can't find it. It's completely gone. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. I want to leave in less than 24 hours. And it's gone. So, cool thing though is I gave them PDF copies of the map I made, and they expedited and printed out a map. So, hopefully, I can print it, I can pick it up here, and it'll be all done, and all will be good. And it's like nothing happened. So, I guess the reason I'm telling you this is one, sort of a venting way for me, but number two is, don't be like me and don't get excited right away. I didn't get excited with anybody. I was just frustrated to myself about the whole thing. And at the end of the day, it really is not that big of a deal. But I was so thankful that it worked out in a positive manner anyway. Mistakes happen every day. So something stupid like that happens to you, cut somebody some slack, give them a break. You don't know what kind of day they've been having, I guess was all I was getting at. But yeah, you know, we're doing that, and just got to pack the truck up, and I'm headed. I'm just pumped up. This this opening day was a little bit on the slower side for me. However, the end of the day heated up very quickly. I didn't see a lot of deer. I took my sister-in-law hunting. This is the second time she's ever gone hunting, and we went out on her new property that she purchased, and around 5 o'clock in the evening, we had a nice 7-pointer come by, and she was able to put a great shot on it and harvested her first buck. I posted some of the pictures on our Instagram page. If you don't follow us already, check it out. It's at Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast. That's where you get a lot of information about the shows we have coming up and some other cool relevant stuff we'll post on there. But that was exciting. I was real happy she was able to connect and shoot her first buck. We've got this this group hunt at my cabin this week. I'm coming home for a day. Then I'm right back out in the woods. I am headed to New Jersey. Monday, December 5th is going to be the opening day of Jersey's bear season that they have not had for 2 years, and I'm participating. So getting the guns all situated for that, I have to use either my inline muzzleloader or a slug gun. So just making sure I've got my guns shooting well, coordinating that, and I'm going to be taking part in that for the first 2 days. So I'm really looking forward. I've got a solid 5 days of hunting and with a bunch of people that I just really enjoy spending time with. There's a couple other people that couldn't make it this year. I wish they could have, because I wish they could be part of it, but that's life, and hopefully there's next year that they can come with us and join us. So this week's episode, I had a conversation with one of our listeners, and that would be Charlie Bear. And I recorded this episode with him a couple of weeks ago and wanted to release it right around now. And I in the meantime, he also did an episode with the Backcountry PA podcast, which, guys, if you haven't listened to that podcast, that's a great podcast. Those guys do. I've listened to a couple of their episodes. They do a great job on that show, and they had Charlie. I didn't get to listen to the episode that they did with Charlie to see, you know, if there was any major differences between my interview with him and theirs, but nevertheless, I had a conversation with Charlie, and it was great. We talked about the buck that he harvested this year in archery season, how he was able to capitalize on that. We talked a lot about mobile hunting and how that transformation of having permanent set stands and being set in his ways of where you're going to go to, reading terrain, monitoring pressure on a property because he's hunting it with other people, and utilizing his sticks and saddle and staying mobile, and how that paid off really, really big for his best buck to date. So it's a great conversation. It was a great chance to catch up with Charlie, and I think he's on to some pretty cool things in that property. I think he's going to be getting on some better and better deer the longer he hunts his properties and fine-tunes his craft. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. Wherever you find yourself this week or next, good luck. Stay safe out there hunting. And that's all we can really hope for is stay safe, and hopefully a little luck goes our way. So have a great week. Thanks for tuning in. Let's get to this episode. All right, so let's get rolling. And tonight we got Charlie Bear, who is coming off of the high of killing his best buck of his life, I think. Charlie, how's it going?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
It's going. I'm at the point where I am tired of looking at Halloween candy. So I spent the past week and a half doing like a one or two stop per night Halloween extravaganza. And everybody that I took the kids to literally gave them not a couple pieces of candy, a bucket full. So you multiply that by about 7 or 8 stops. I've got candy coming out of my ears, and it's really not what I needed to see. Like, I feel like every time I pack food to go out hunting, I want to pack something good that's going to give you energy, not give you a sugar dump when you're in a tree stand. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm the same way. My son, he's almost 2, so this is his second Halloween, but really his first one being mobile and getting around. So all the neighbors, of course, like you said, wanted to spoil him. And that's the last thing I need, but I'm already known for stealing his snacks from my lunches and his go-go squeezes and, you know, all his goodies. So I didn't mind. But, yeah, like you said, it's It's wearing off. They finally pulled it up 50% off at Walmart. I saw tonight. So.
I'm at the at my problem though is like I'm gonna have to like get into a more strict routine of like working out and doing things again, because this time of year when it comes to like physical activity, like I go work, hunt, everything else that I have to do, and like nothing else that you should do gets done. It's like on hold during hunting season. I don't know why. Like I remember when I played football, like you try to keep a weekly lift in just to maintain muscle mass and do all this stuff, and I feel like that always got pushed to the wayside. And I feel like doing anything positive that's, you know, healthy for your body during hunting season, it's like it doesn't matter. It's time to go. It's time to go. It's time to go.
And it doesn't help that you have, like you said, the Halloween candy, and then right after that you have Thanksgiving, and then it's dark all day.
Oh, potato filling.
Yeah, and then so I mean you have nothing else to do besides just sitting there inside and comfort, get all the comfort food, and you know, if you're lucky enough to harvest a deer, you get the chili out, and you know, it's hard.
And you'll be running with the chili mindset, and you'll be running with the mindset that even if you do overindulge on Thanksgiving, it won't be painful to get up on Saturday morning and go after a buck because you're tagged out. And what a heck of a deer. Congratulations. Was that a deer that you were following of any suit, or just kind of happenstance the way it happened this year?
No, first, thank you. And no, not really at all. We had no history, myself or the other guys in the area that, you know, hunt that property. We have no pictures. I'm still waiting back to hear from the guy that lives across the road. I work for a strip mine, so we have leases, and the guy across the road was one of our property owners. He asked for some pictures, and he's hunted on the property, so we're kind of waiting to see if he had any from, you know, the past year or even this year. But it was one of those nights where I think the Wednesday before, it was a straight south wind, and it switched directly to a north all day on Thursday. So I don't know if he was just, you know, he's a satellite buck, if he was cruising, pecking does, or if he followed, you know, came with the does, if they were shifting bedding areas. But yeah, pretty much he came in with the two does and made a rub, followed them into about 40 yards, and I picked an opening, and I was filming him the whole time, you know, and I pulled my camera over to an opening where the first doe went through was about 39, 40 yards, and the second doe held up at about 20 yards before that, and just for whatever reason turned directly away and just walked away, and that's where he decided to go, unfortunately. Mm. So I wasn't able to hunt that Friday, so it was the 28th, would have been the next day, Halloween weekend. I had prior obligations, you know, family, so I'm immediately thinking, how am I going to kill this deer Saturday morning? Well, you know, where is he going to be? Where are these does going to be on Saturday morning? And it wasn't, maybe a half an hour later, I hear a couple branches break to my right, which is the way that first doe fed off. And look up, and all I see is a rack coming directly toward to the tree. He had somehow skirted me, and when scent checked, bred, whatever, you know, that doe checked and came back looking for that other doe. There was a smaller 8-point. Came in directly behind me. He ran him off earlier on, but this was all about a half an hour, you know, him back and forth, just pretty much checking the does. He wasn't really, you know, bumping them or seeking or anything like that. I got a lot of those questions, you know, was he running them? Was he, you know, bumping them? Was he anything like that? And the only thing, he was territorial. There's no doubt about that. Like I said, he ran off that smaller eight, but he didn't like the fact that they broke up. He wanted to keep those two does together. And essentially that was the end of that. That's what killed him in the end. Curiosity.
I feel like that's what kills most of them. They let their guard down at one specific time. In that time frame that you killed your buck, I got a lot of pictures from friends and just, you know, seeing stuff on my feed of people seeing good deer, shooting good deer. I had some great encounters the one day that I was out with one of my buddies. It just seemed like there was something about it in the air that was kind of really, I guess, shifting gears, so to speak. I kind of want to go back a little bit. So you'd mentioned the property you hunt, you know, nobody knew that deer kind of deal. So the setup that you're hunting, are you doing like It sounds like it's private land. Is it private land lease? You know, asked by permission only. Is it family, friends? Like, what grants you access to that property, and then what kind of flexibility do you have to approach that property throughout a calendar year to make it successful?
I'm actually very fortunate that my company owns the property. So, like I said, I work in a strip mining company, so we do have leases. That most of those are farms. They're usually not letting people hunt. Just they usually have hunters, or you know, they hunt themselves. We actually own the property that I'm hunting on. So, in the past, they've let neighbors on. Like I said, the guy across the road, he had a lease with us, so he's been allowed on in the past. There are a couple other guys that do have stands on the property. One of them actually tagged out the first week, so it was kind of down to just me and one other guy archery hunting. From what I've understood, this is only the first year I've archery hunted it. That's actually only my third sit on the property, and they've never really killed very many good deer out of there. They say a lot of the time rifle. Those guys, the guys that have been there for 8-10 years, ever since they put that, you know, that plant there, those guys end up killing a good deer. But yeah, I mean, if you look back on my Instagram page, I had a video of about 12 or 14 bucks come across the field in middle of July. And one of them had, his G2s were about 12 or 13 inches long. And he was actually the buck that I was in back in after. He showed back up, and he was kind of pretty frequent. The dozer operator actually saw him bedded down, running a smaller buck off, pinning a doe down a couple of days before that, probably about 100 yards from where I was set up. So he was actually the buck I was in after. And like I said, that was just pure luck that a bigger one came through just to happen.
There's nothing wrong when that happens. So first year hunting this property, what kind of off-season preparation did you have going into this property? Because from my perspective, if there's been very little people that have been able to connect on this property prior to you or the other people that are hunting, what led you to having a little bit better edge or advantage in this situation compared to everybody else, or what put you a step above in that sense?
Definitely mobile hunting. Everybody else that's ever hunted that property, they just set stands, and even if they were, you know, they weren't seeing deer in range, they weren't moving the stands. They were just, well, I'm seeing deer, so that one day they thought that something might come through. And I mean, I think that was the issue. They were seeing deer all year long. I took that to my advantage. I could actually see one of the stands. The one guy that I work with, he hung, and he kept telling me he was getting skirted by deer, whether it was does or small bucks. I laid eyes on a shooter the first week in there on the other side of the property. But he kept telling me, you know, I'm getting skirted by these deer. And we told him for the first 2 weeks to move your stand. And he wasn't in there that night. He says, go down there and see what you can do. And I went up just off the point of like an oak system, an oak flat kind of, drops down into a bench into a creek bottom. And I went just on the, right off where it drops into the bench. And that they came right up at that creek bottom from behind me off the hill. Like I said, I could see his stand. So maybe he may have been able, you know, if it may, a set stand may have been the ticket that night. But the fact that I was able to cover, the property lays out like a boomerang kind of creek bottom. And I kind of pinpointed the north, south, and be like the southwest, kind of pinpointing the areas where I thought the most area, you know, most traffic would be. And just so happened the third spot I picked was the honey hole.
So I've had a lot of good luck with pre-hung stands in my experience. However, most of the time those pre-hung stands are not getting hunted a lot. You know, it's I'm trying to wait for the right wind direction to get into that stand and get out of that stand. It's placed well in advance, no intrusion, close to the time when I want to hunt. and it's got features that are going to bring deer within bow range, hopefully. So, you know, taking all that into account, I'm going in and making the most of it. But I can easily see, and this would be what I'd be curious about, this individual and this stand location, was it something that was getting hunted on a regular basis on any wind direction? Was there some kind of flaw in access that you saw and you took advantage of a different access into this location? Tell me a little bit about that.
No, he was actually hunting it almost every other day. He was in there quite frequent, and the other guy that had a stand in there, it was only maybe 125 yards away, and he was bouncing back and forth in between those stands, and I kind of stayed on the other side of the property away from him, and I kind of accessed similar to him. I didn't go in there until I had the right wind, per se. He was maybe hunting it on, I can hunt on Wednesday, so I'm going to hunt the stand. Mm-hmm. I got a good picture there. I was more of guessing, I guess I should say, you know, if I back myself into that creek bottom, something would be walking down that ridge in front of me at some point throughout the evening, whether it was something of a caliber of the buck I shot, or so I figured something would be cruising through there, just with the terrain, the history that he's had in that area. But yeah, I pretty much use the same exact access. It's just the wind direction was the big thing that night, the big switch from Wednesday to Thursday.
So there was a switch in the direction of the wind. So obviously that wind switched in a direction that you could get to where you could get where you right. ended up being in a stand, not be detected on stand. Was there anything about the wind that you felt was better for deer movement in that sense? Or is the wind-based movement, wind-based bedding kind of thing, is that something that you paid attention to in any sense? Or was it just from the sheer fact that I could get into this good location that seems pretty intrusive, but I can get aggressive and it's going to be favorable for me to at least get there?
A little bit of both. I'm always trying to use the wind as in access. I think that's everybody's main goal. But the big, I like you said, I do kind of target wind. There's big wind changes. You don't really, you'll see like a south to southwest to west wind. And this went from a direct south to a direct north. And then over the next couple of days, it went, it was going from to a straight east, I think, on Friday and Saturday. So I was paying attention to that big time. I think we talked earlier about people you knew that those days, cameras was blowing up. I actually pulled cards the next Sunday. And from the 26th until the 30th, I had, I don't know how many shooter bucks just on one property, just cruising that creek bottom, hitting every scrape up and down, daylight, midnight. So I think that those honing into those big wind changes and cold fronts, even warm fronts coming in, get down into those creek bottoms where they get, it's cooler. You're going to get movement, whether it's early, midday. They're going to have to come down there at some point. That's just, and then the other thing is with where we're working, there's a lot of equipment running. So we use that to our advantage. I try to use that to my advantage. Some of the guys think it's a disadvantage. I actually drove by a bedded buck about four or five times today, probably 120 inch deer. And he was watching a triaxial up and down the road all day. He watched me stop, look at him, take a picture. So they're used to it. It's like they come to the noise and they feel safe that way. So I kind of use that to my advantage. Where was the guy running equipment today? Well, he's probably watching that direction if he's betting over here. So all those things definitely play a factor in that specific location of hunting.
When I relate this back to hunting all the time, I'll never forget when I went on my honeymoon with my wife. We went to South Africa and did a photo safari, which was really, really a cool experience. And I'll never forget going through and doing this photo safari. We'd go through on a bush jeep, and drive literally anywhere. And they'd say, what do you want to see today? And we'd say, well, it'd be kind of cool to see this. And they'd go drive through the bush and try to find stuff. And they would literally drive right up to a pride of lions or drive right up to a herd of antelope or something like that. And I said, I know that this isn't a danger to them, but I still cannot fathom that they allow this to happen. And he said, at this one point in the trip, we were driving up, and he said, all right, when we get up next to this herd of antelope and we stop, I want you to stand up. Okay. So literally got a mere 10 yards. And the minute that I stood up, every antelope in that group had its ears pinned forward, its eyes locked on me, and took off like crazy. And I looked at him, and I said, okay. I said, he saw me. What's your point? He goes, when you look at this Jeep, he said, when you look at the noise it makes, the smells that it makes, and the things that it does, it's not something that they can eat, it's not something that they can breed with, and it's not something that has ever caused them any harm. He said, so it's just a negative, it's not a negative stimuli to them. There's no danger associated with it. He said, but the minute that you stood up and they saw a human profile, he said, that's something that they can associate with danger. And, you know, I think that back to hunting, what you just said, like, I've been in so many situations where even people noise, but it was in an area that was non-associated with them. Like, I've done a little bit of urban hunting here around my place, in a sense, and you can have, like, I've seen deer come through my property and watch my dogs run up to their electric fence and stop. And they'll just watch the dogs, and they don't run, they don't take off and carry on, but the minute that you cross that boundary and they know that there's something out of their zone where they're used to going, that's when it's kind of like, okay, red flag. And that equipment noise, I mean, I've run into that same thing. I mean, there's definitely something to be said about animals getting accustomed to human noises, and I think that's an excellent strategy on that property. I mean, kind of one in Rome doing Rome, I guess. Yeah. So the mobile hunting aspect of things. So I think I saw on your Instagram that you were running a saddle.
Yeah. I mean, I would say 90% of the time I hunt out of my saddle. Like you said, I do have my pre-hunts, and I try to not go into those spots until this time of the year. I run cameras in them, those areas, and they soak there, and I check them very seldomly. Go in there with the right wind, the right time of year, and that's about it. That's about 10% of the hunting. The 90%, I'm still hunting a lot of private land. It's just the mobility and the access and and all the different opportunities it gives you. You know, I was blown away the first, you know, this is my fourth year doing it.
Okay. And I was going to ask you that. How long have you been doing this?
Yeah, this is my fourth year into it. So, I'm invested now, to say the least, in it. I'm pretty comfortable with my setup, to the fact where I hardly use a light anymore. I can flick my light on and off, take my time, still be quiet, set up fast or slow is fast, and so, you know, any kind of saddle hunting or pre-hanging or, you know, hanging hunts, I guess it would be. But yeah, that was actually my first buck out of a saddle.
Okay.
I've shot a couple does, but that was my first buck out of a saddle.
So the hanging hunts that you've been doing, was that something that, were you doing hanging hunts on a lot of the hunts that you did prior to saddle hunting, or did kind of the really excitement and I don't know if I want to use the word hype, but the excitement of saddle hunting that's happened recently in the past 5, 6, 7 years or whatever, was that something that you said, hey, I want to give this a try? It might be another tool in my toolbox.
Yeah, I was sitting in my pre-hung stand, and it was probably going on about the 15th set of the season. This was probably 6, 7, 8 years ago now, and I was just getting skirted for like the third year in a row by deer. And that's right about the time the hunting public really, you know, started blowing up. Mm-hmm. And they were doing hanging hunts. So I got like an XOP stand, some hawk helium sticks, and saw what it was all about. And it It was a huge learning curve. Nobody I knew did it, so I was kind of out on my own, trying to watch YouTube videos on it, go out, practice, come back, you know. That lasted about a half a season, and I switched the saddle. Just once I would get up to my top stick and hang that my tree stand. I mean, I was comfortable in a tree stand. I didn't mind the extra weight because where I'm at, I'm not walking, you know, very far. If a mile is a very, very long day, and I'm probably lost or, you know, tracking something at that point. So the weight wasn't really an issue with the hanging hunts. It was more just comfortable. I mean, I have my hip, you know, my tether point to the place where I have zero hip pressure point. You know, everybody complains about their hips hurting in the saddle. Once I got locked down, that was kind of my go-to. So I kind of progressed. I went through the climber stage. So, I mean, yeah, I did it all. I started and I did, like you said, kind of went through the hype, you know, the climbers, the hanging hunt, the saddle. I still would probably say that my Summit Viper was probably the most comfortable out of anything that I, you know, any kind of mobile setup that I had. It was just so dang big.
I like to ask everybody that's kind of gravitated towards the saddle, do you ever find a situation where you think, man, a climber or a tree stand would be better in this situation? Or are you to the point now with doing this that you're pretty much sold in every way, shape, or form that this is better for you?
The only thing that I run into would be height. So I'm getting about 16 feet. Probably about my hip is about 16 feet up, which I'm comfortable with most of the year. This time of year, you're running into nothing in the trees. You're sticking out like a sore thumb. So unless you're one sticking, which I don't see me ever going that into it, you're kind of limited on how high you're going to get with a saddle. I have run in situations, you know, once the end of October comes, beginning of November, kind of wishing I would have hung on to a climber just for times like that where maybe you needed to get an extra 6 or 8 feet to, you know, get up to that cover. So there are definitely those times where I miss the ability to the height. That's about the only thing I can complain about.
I've been called a little bit crazy, and I guess it just stems from people that I've hunted with in the past, but I've never really, when I was younger, I guess I did, but I've just gotten so used to it. I haven't feared, as long as I'm attached to the tree, I don't fear going higher than most people. I've been in cases where I was in a climber tree stand, and I know that I was between 30 and 35 feet in a climber tree stand. The only reason I know that is because I know how long my pull-up rope was, and when I was getting to a point and I start feeling it pulling up on my hip a little bit, I know I'm about, you know, 30 to 35 feet. I've hunted with people that hunt higher than that, which for me is too much, but I mean, there's definitely an advantage, a sight advantage or a disadvantage for the deer, however you want to look at it, when you're hunting that high. And, you know, some of the places I've hunted in, I'll say big woods in central Pennsylvania, north central Pennsylvania, some of the tree types are just a lot more conducive for a climber tree stand and be able to get up and go. But I will say hunting around some chop-offs, hunting around, I hunted a small marsh property in southeast Pennsylvania, and the tree types, it's just a lot easier if you have a pre-hung hang-on or you do a hang-and-hunt setup. And I've used the saddle. It's something that I'm not 100% comfortable with, but I'm just right now where I'm at, I'm just looking at it as a tool in the toolbox for the places I go. And I think it's really fascinating. More and more people have gravitated towards it, and I don't see people stopping. Like it seems like a lot of people are really enjoying using their saddles.
Yeah, I mean, I like we talked earlier, I had full access to hang 50 stands on that property if I chose. But it's not, I mean, some people think it's a secretive. Well, you don't want people to know you're there. I mean, that definitely helps. I mean, if someone is else, you know, hunting on that property and they're not seeing stands, they may think, oh, well, you know, or they see two stands on one side of the property and they're not seeing anything on the other side. Well, maybe those guys didn't put those stands over there because I was going to be bouncing back and forth on that ridge throughout the season.
Do you find you're willing to get more aggressive when you've got that setup because you don't have the investment of hanging that stand ahead of time and the thought of hunting it multiple times?
Absolutely, because, I mean, there are times where my pre-hunt would just – you would sit there and you know, in your vehicle in the morning and just kind of beat yourself up on which stand am I going to go to. And then, you know, if you get there and the weatherman, you know, wasn't right, then
– Oh, does that happen?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've hunted the same trail on two or three winds, you know, the same scrape on two or three winds with a saddle or mm-hmm. even a hanging hunt setup. I've actually torn down a stand when it was a pre-hung in the middle of a set and moved it. And that was kind of right in the transition of me getting into, you know, hanging hunts was just the mobility and the ability, I guess it would be to hunt the same area, but in any situation. If I like I said, if I showed up and I checked the wind and it's on southwest and it was supposed to be a northwest, I'm not dead in the water. Then I can just maybe cross that trail and set up that way.
And what, I don't know if you would have this experience or not, but like this year, this property you killed this buck on. You said it was, I think you said the first year that you hunted this property or second year. And there's definitely a case in point when it's a newer property, it's still fresh to you, kind of green hanging stands. You might do all your homework the best you can, but I've been in that situation where you scouted, you thought this is the place to hang a tree stand, and you hunt it and you realize it should be a little bit different, or I should have accessed this way, or I should have done that way. And when you also throw in the aspect of pressure and hunting with other people, that's an added element to it. Do you think, though, if you had a property that you had to yourself and you had a long-term history with, do you think that there's still an advantage to hunting that style with a saddle, a mobile setup? Or do you think that would be a case in point where maybe it would be a tool, but I might feel more comfortable doing it? Like, what are your thoughts?
I wouldn't be against if, say I owned that property. I would not be against hanging. I could see myself on that probably hanging three or four stands, and they would be my all-day sit rut stands. But I would still probably get aggressive and even hunt around those stands, but not, you know, within 50 yards, within eyesight of them maybe. Kind of maybe do almost observation sits on those stands, you know. If you're putting those stands in the position to kill a deer in the rut, I think skirting, like, so the guy that had the stand set up there at that property, that was probably more of a rut. It was on a north to south trail. There's bucks were going to be cruising, checking a west wind. So he set it up for the rut. So I would still probably have a stand similar to that. There's nothing against that stand. I think it's in a great spot. However, it was a week and a half, 2 weeks before the actual, what I consider rut hitting. So moving just on that outside of that bubble, you're catching those deer that maybe aren't really running that trail yet. It's mm-hmm. kind of like hanging a trail camera and not knowing what's on the backside of the tree the whole year, never hunting that property because, well, there's no deer. I didn't get a picture of them. Mm-hmm. But the whole time there's, you know, Pope and Young walking behind, or, you know, and you have no idea. So I think a lot of those times, those stands do come in handy, and they are a great tool to have. But I think I still would find myself using my saddle to kind of scout and try to get lucky on a early season buck.
You said your access, you kind of took a very similar access to how the other hunter was going in this area, but you pushed in a little bit farther. So I'm curious about that aspect of, like, where he would stop at his stand. What kept your access safe from that point to where you ended up hanging your stand? And I'm curious what made you choose that location. Was it just the sheer fact that the description was it was skirting, or were there things about the spot that you hung your stand that pinched deer a little bit closer, any terrain features that really said, this is where I want to be set up at this time of year? Was there any sign that really said, this is where I need to stop?
Off in the distance, I was going to that area. There's some pines on the other side of the creek, and it was a warmer day, so I kind of figured they'd maybe bend up in the shade. I was going a little bit deeper than I actually went. There was a couple fresh shrubs I could see off in the distance. That was the first time I was down there when the leaves were kind of starting to come off, so I could see a little bit better, and I noticed what I thought was a scrape. It ended up being, wasn't a community scrape, but it was a good size scrape. It was about 60 yards away from where I actually set up. And once I got to that point, it's like a ridge point system right there. It drops off into the creek. And there's a bench that probably runs 150 yards along the creek. It's about 60 yards wide and has that real thick greenbrier all through it. So that's where I was kind of on the edge of that. And that's right where they came up through and fed up out of. So it was kind of terrain feature. The fact that I knew that there were deer in the area were skirting him. Mm-hmm. The creek had a lot to do with it. Like I said, warmer day. I knew there was good cover up in there. It felt like something should be there. I surely didn't expect what came through to be there, but yeah, I mean, it was one of those feelings where it started feeling real bucky. If you know what I mean, you get in those situations where, yeah, pushing deeper, it could have paid off. I may have been successful on another deer. I may have been successful on him. You never know, but I think that it was just one of those situations that I kind of met myself in the middle from where I initially wanted to go and where I ended up. I kind of just met myself in the middle and it worked out.
So when you were on stand, explain to me what the prevailing wind direction was doing in relation to where you saw deer predominantly coming from. And was there any thermal switches you were anticipating or any changes in the thermals while you were on stand that maybe you thought this is just 100% my advantage? Or, you know, you talked about watching the wind from an aspect of deer using it. Did you see anything in your mind that said, you know, I'm kind of just cutting this, or, you know, what are your thoughts?
I was pretty comfortable with the wind the entire night. It was a north wind, as I said before, but it was in my face. I was facing the northeast-ish, I guess you could say. Wind was coming from predominantly the north. They came from my southwest, so over my left shoulder, and they were kind of walking, cutting the wind. You know, he was following the doe, so they were kind of cutting the wind. And I never felt that I was at a disadvantage, because right off the bat, if anything didn't come off that backside behind me out of that, you know, the thick cover of the pines, I felt like that's where my thermals would pull up at some point down towards that creek. That smaller buck came directly downwind to me. So I don't know if that doe, one of those does were hot, if he didn't, you know, if that was the case, or if, you know, my thermals may have been pulling up, you know, a different direction. But when he came back in, he was walking with the wind at his back. And I have a video of him walking up to about 10, 12 yards and just staring at my tree. And I was hiding behind my tree watching him in the viewfinder for about 2.5 minutes. Mm. And he knew something wasn't right. And that was where saddle hunting kind of came in handy, because I was literally hiding behind the tree with my bow in one hand and turned, you know, and just that viewfinder was the only thing that was saving me. If I wouldn't have switched over to self-filming this year, then he knew something was up, and he slowly started backing up and bound off to about 50 yards. Mm. And then but he still wanted behind me. So I don't know if, you know, he thought that other buck was down there. If that doe went back down there, but for some reason, you know, he was doing something a buck you wouldn't think would do with that wind, because the wind was at his back, and there was, if you knew the layout, I mean, it was an open pit, essentially a field with it's just a big hole behind him. So he knew, and he came from that direction. So I would imagine he knew there was no danger up there, and he was walking into what essentially was ended up being danger to him. And he did something. That's why I thought there was a doe. One of those doe had to have been hot to get him that. He was just getting to the beginning stages of that goofiness, you know, where he was when he skirted me, bounded off about 50 yards, and he just skirted and quartered to about 35. He wasn't acting like a big buck should act, which it played into my advantage, obviously.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, did you happen to put a tape on that deer?
No, I did not yet. My rough guess was everybody had talked about 135 or be 140 if I'm lucky. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've never, the biggest thing I've ever think I put a tape on is about 126. So I didn't really have anything to compare them to. I know
it's
that
unique rack.
What's that?
It's a unique rack with some of the kickers and characters. It makes it deceiving when you want to put a number to it.
Yeah, because anybody that I've talked to that split G3, it's going to be, I guess it's going to be non-typical now. Mm. So that's going to be a deduction of score. I mean, either way, I'm happy with them.
Yeah, who cares regardless
of what he scores. But like I said, that 120, 125, 126 I have, he fits inside of them. So.
Yeah, a lot of I ask that question, and I ask it lightly because there's a lot of hunters that hear that about score, and they almost like borderline get offended that, you know, it's not about the score, and it's not. It's just a, like when you put a score and a number to it, it just gives you a metric. Like there's a standard metric of gauging, you know, what it actually had on its head, and just gauging that, comparing to it. And do I hunt for score? Oh my gosh, no. I really don't care. I mean, you know, the deer I, you know, to put a score to my buck, I don't think I said this, but the buck I killed this year was 111 inches. And I was thrilled with that. You know, it was a 225-pound deer, and I was thrilled. The experience was very similar to any other buck I killed. And, you know,
if a 110-inch deer walks by next year, I can't say that I'm not going to shoot it. I mean, if I'm lucky enough to get on a good deer again and you know, maybe hunt him down and have history with one next year and put one down that way, that'd be a great story and another, you know, another great memory. But you know, like you said, I'm not out there after the number. It's just, this is the first one that I consider something worth scoring. I mean, he's at the taxidermist. He was there Saturday. I dropped him off. So he's the first one that was worth going to get stuffed and put a tape on. So we'll see how he comes back. He was anticipating about an April return, so that's my birthday month. So happy birthday to me, hopefully.
So when I sit on stand this time of year, especially after I shoot my buck, I'm worse for then, because like when I don't shoot my buck, I'm still thinking like strategy and, you know, what the forecast is and what this wind direction is going to lead me to this stand and when I have time to get on stand and this set. But like especially after I shoot my buck, when I go and stand and there's I hunt some private places that I have the ability to manipulate things to improve my hunting, whether that's cutting trees or food plots or, you know, whatever. So a couple stands that I was on this year, mainly the one at my place, I would be on stand and I'd be thinking, man, I really need to improve this section of the property and this section of the property and neck down these trails and make it a little bit higher traction to funnel them into this bow shot. And I ask you, when you're on stand on this property, are the things going through your mind that you say, I want to learn how to access this property a little bit better? There's something I want to learn about this property for next year, whether that's in my off season scouting or maybe it's, you know, going to shoot a doe. You know, are there things in your mind that you're looking to prepare to make better for next season already?
Right now, I'm kind of watching from a distance for the time being, and I'm lucky enough to be able to do that. I operate equipment, so I can kind of monitor the woods and the edge of the woods this time of year from equipment, so I don't necessarily have to be in the woods every day. There is another guy still down in there hunting, so I try to be respectful out of him, you know, not going down in there necessarily right now, but I know as soon as season is you know, over, or he's tagged out or moves on to another spot, I'll be back in there, and I'll, yeah, like you said, there are a couple more places in that property that I still do want to dive into. I found the first night I sat in that property, I saw a real heavy horn buck, and he was very pretty impressive. I don't want to say he would score more than that buck, but he would push everything that buck is going to score that I shot. Just the mass that he had, he was a very impressive deer, and I never even made it to that side of the property again. And so, I mean, and that's just, that's definitely something that in the later season, I'm a big fan of February scouting. You find those fresh beds, you get into those places where the ice is, and, you know, might be a lot harder access in the spring once everything melts off. So I definitely will dive into those spots then. Like I said, if I am lucky enough, I don't feel that I'm disrespecting anybody by going in there, you know, this season, then I will go in there with my bow and tackle that other side of the property and try to pinpoint maybe a good location over there for next year and see maybe if there's anything good, you know, big deer living in there, holding in that area, and kind of put that in my memory bank for next year. I mean, even when I was out the Sunday after I shot my buck, I was pulling cameras and their cards, and I was still kind of caught myself hunting. I mean, even though I shot a buck and a doe already, I found myself still sneaking through the woods, you know, still. I find a new fresh rub and mental note that, and, well, why is he traveling right here? And just always kind of, I guess, always trying to learn and look for next year, where the next one's going to be.
Yeah, I overwhelmed myself with that too much, and I was talking about it with some of my hunting buddies and said, you know, you think too much and you give deer too much credit, and, you know, they definitely don't process things the way that we do, but it just feels like it's ever changing, and I guess so fixated on trying to shoot the best deer and trying to think of where they are. And the one thing that I've listened to a lot of other really, really good hunters and people I've had on my show and stuff like that, and one of the things I'm really noticing this year is, and we talked about it earlier in this conversation, was wind, and not necessarily the thought that the wind direction is blowing left to right, so I need to make sure that I don't let my wind blow into this section of the property so nothing smells me. That's definitely very, very important to me. But along the sense of thinking more about what the wind is doing for the deer and how they use that, I've noticed a couple locations that I hunt, I was seeing deer bed in certain locations, and I used to always just wonder why. And the more I'm paying attention to how the wind and understanding thermals, and that's one of the things, like, people talk about thermals and watching thermals and how thermals work. I don't think you ever perfect learning how thermals and air currents move, especially when there's terrain added to it. Like, yeah. It's a constant learning. And I've been hunting my whole life, and I've shot some great deer and had some great hunting experiences, and I still feel like I'm a novice when it comes to learning the wind and being a steward of wind and thinking about it from the perspective of how is this wind being an advantage for the deer, and then how can I try to cut it off? Like it's so hard, and like I've been told so many times that you're overthinking it. Deer don't do that, but I believe they do, because they're a prey species. that are getting hunted by people, and it's still innate in them when, you know, even though we don't have, you know, what is the biggest predator in Pennsylvania? I guess bear.
Bear, yeah.
Coyotes maybe. I mean, coyotes definitely a tribute to deer, but I haven't seen that coyotes are taking, you know, herds of deer down. But, I mean, that predatory instinct is still in that species, and they've got to use their nose to set themselves up.
I like to look at it as if you relied on, okay, say your nose was your greatest defense mechanism, and you went into the woods. I heard this broken down this way on a podcast. I can't remember who it was, but they said if you walk into a property and you had to survive, where would you go? If you had to, you know, base off your nose or your senses like a deer, you would find those little corners where, you know, people say the balloons are landing. Well, yeah, they land there because that's all the air is being sucked to. Those deer, like, you know, they find those areas. We don't feel the thermals. I mean, very seldomly will you feel, well, I've ever noticed, you know, a slight one on your neck or something, you know, in the morning or in the evening. But if you had to survive that way, then I'm sure you would pay attention to them a lot more too.
I noticed one time, just recently this year, I say one time, it was this season, I had a deer come and it crossed my downwind and didn't even flinch. And it was toward the end of the hunt, and I was kind of on a little bit of a slope, and I had just your standard powder wind checker, and my wind was still going right in that direction. You know, I'm up in a tree 20 plus feet, and my wind direction was still going right towards him. However, I had milkweed with me as well, and let the milkweed go, and the milkweed started to drift the same way that my air current was going with that powder bottle. But as gravity started to pull that milkweed down, I noticed that the milkweed completely shifted and started to go down the hill, which therefore was not pulling my scent down. So my wind had to be like swirling a little bit, but the thermal had to be pulling it down, and at the ground level where that deer was, I'm assuming that's why it didn't smell me. And I just, like, so many cases like that when you're on stand, how is it an advantage? And it's just a constant learning thing. And another thing, we talked about, you know, bedding. Like I trailed a buck this year that was shot, and where he was bedding, you literally could not see more than 6 to 7 feet in front. Like, it was just thick, high stem count briars. We literally had to crawl on trails to go through and recover the steer where he laid down and died. And then you get into some other situations where it's like a room with a view, and it's just so fascinating how they can use all their senses to their advantage. And like, sometimes I think, like, how do we even kill these things? Because it just seems so incredible how they set themselves up for survival. But, you know, in your case in point, and my case in point, they let their guard down at one time and you make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, even on the way to work this morning, I saw a small buck just standing in the middle of the road. I mean, there's snot coming out of his nose, panting, and it was probably another mile down the road, probably 130-inch deer, doing the same thing, you know, 10 yards off the road, just running around. Like, you know, it's just that time of year, and as much as I want to say, you know, I the big buck killer, you know, I hunted him down and had this great story, and it was more luck than anything. I was just, you know, right place, right time. And I was, kept myself calm enough to make a good shot. And he only went about 60 yards, 70 yards and bedded down. And we found him in his first bed about an hour and a half after I shot him. So
everybody has their own philosophy on if luck is a thing, or, you know, if some people have luck. And I definitely believe luck is a thing, but luck is something that also follows those who are well prepared. And I think, you know, the things you're telling me and how you approach this deer, I think every deer that I've ever shot in my life attributed to luck, but I think I might have done something that maybe gave me a slight advantage, you know, right, in that direction. And I would definitely say that even with some luck involved, the strategy behind it. And that's what I love. I love to hear everybody's philosophy and the strategy that goes into it that made them successful. And I want to follow that up. You know, I kind of asked you what your thoughts were next year. In your hunting career and where you're at going through, like, what's something that stands out? You're like, I want to be better at this when it comes to hunting. And whether that's something within your equipment or how you set up or how you learn or this specific part of deer behavior, like, what's something that you were like, I really want to improve this?
I definitely want to become more patient. Just in the fact of when I'm in the woods, I want to be more patient. When I'm setting up, I can be very methodical and, you know, every stick I can take my time and really concentrate on that. But I struggle with when I'm entering the woods or leaving the woods. It's like the hurry up, like, oh, I kind of want to get there. And instead of taking my time, lower my heart rate and just mentally being there. So I definitely need to work on my mental, just as soon as I close that vehicle door, just take a deep breath and, you know why I'm there, that I'm hunting, and just slow everything down and just learn some patience that way. But I really want to, you hear about buck bedding, and like you get their main bed that they use the most often, and then, you know, you get their secondary bed. And I've been able to come across a lot of deer's first and secondary beds, but it's the oh crap bed, third bed, that I've never been able to find. I really want to hone in and try to focus on that, because I think that's where you can be really successful in killing the big, big deer. The deer like size and, you know, ones I shot this year. I think you can shoot those deer in Pennsylvania if you can find that third bed, that when everything's hitting the fan and they don't, you know, they've had bullets whizzing and everything, they have that one bed that they travel maybe 50, 60 yard bubble every day. I really want to figure out and learn, you know, where and how to zero in on those locations.
Well, let's face it, some of the best hunters in the country that we know about today that talk about this, you know, they go into the intricate levels of detail in that style of hunting, and it's something that's definitely difficult. It's hard to hone in, but the people who do it are typically very, very successful. And I think there's definitely some merit to that style of hunting with relationship to the type of habitat and terrain you hunt, and also the level of hunting pressure. So, you know, I'm gonna play devil's advocate on that one for a second, just because this is what I'm going to, like, my comfort zone for a second. But if you have the ability to find deer or hunt deer that are moderately pressured or have lower pressure, I don't feel like there's this gravitating need for a buck to, like, constantly go to this one sole bed. I think they have their areas they're like, and they're definitely creatures of habit in a sense, especially, you know, throughout a time of year. And then, you know, I said about the type of habitat, you know, some of the larger monotonous mountain land, it's really, really difficult to pinpoint, oh, this is a one bed. Yeah, they might use this one bed, but they might also have six other ridges with different wind directions and everything else, and different food sources that they still relate to. There's more bedding opportunity. So bedding opportunity, I think, is one. Now, I say that all the sense that where you're at in learning and improving in your hunting, that's where I am. I think it's a style and something that I think is able to make you understand deer behavior a little bit better and just give you one more tool in your toolbox. It's very, very aggressive, and I'm not a very aggressive hunter. And I think that's just something that if I would be more comfortable in learning when to take those risks and when not to, I feel like it's got to make you a better hunter, right?
Yeah, I mean, I owe that, my success this year, to being aggressive. And like I said, I only hunted that property three times this year, and three, maybe four, but I never hunted the same area, like I said, more than once. And I never hunted the same area in general more than once this entire season, I don't think. So I think the whole just being aggressive, I'm not saying that if I wouldn't have climbed up in that pre-hung stand, I wouldn't have shot that deer, but I owed it to where my setup was and how comfortable I got with that, and just the fact that if I did see that deer that night, that I was already thinking, well, Saturday morning, where's he going to be? Where may he be going to bed on an east window, or where may those does be on Saturday morning? So if I didn't have that in my pocket, as you know, in my tool belt, then I might have been in a different situation. I might have had to watch him walk and hope he walked by a preset stand, you know, again, the next time I was out there.
Yeah, when you're hunting public land or, you know, by permission property that you're not manipulating and you can't do the things to make deer walk where you want, it can be really, really hard to bottleneck into a bow shot. Not that you can't pick the one stand that it happens in, like you just said. It just, it becomes tricky. You know, I've been fortunate, like the buck I killed 2 years ago. I did a lot of specific things to try to pull that deer into bow range. But that's a case-by-case basis, and I can really see how, you know, the stuff that you're talking, that a lot of people are talking and pushing, it's like a big, excited, it's almost like a new thing now, because it's information overload, and a lot of people are learning about how to do this style hunting, and it's very, very effective. Really cool. I'm just thankful to hear this story. Thank you for sharing your thoughts, your experiences. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Good deal. Well, hey, best of luck filling the freezer, enjoying the rest of your season. And you'd said to me before we got started, maybe a trip to Ohio's on the agenda. So I guess
we're still up in the air about it, but I think I might try my luck over there in November.
Yeah, best of luck to you. Hopefully you can connect something. And, you know, who knows, maybe that'll open a whole other can of worms in your plans for next year, too.
All righty. Thanks. Good luck to you. Take care.
Take care.